My pleasure.
Let me now introduce our honored guest and we'll begin our program. Mary McAleese served as President of Ireland from 1997 to 2011. Her tenure as president extended over two successive seven-year terms, the second of which she ran unopposed as an independent candidate without party affiliation. One important feature of her presidency was the attention that she gave and the success she had in helping to create and sustain peace in her home territory of Northern Ireland, where the Good Friday Agreement of 1998 ended the violent 30-year conflict known as the Troubles. Having experienced the violence of political and sectarian conflict firsthand, she made building bridges the slogan of her administration. She also led the Republic of Ireland during its years as the Celtic Tiger, the fastest growing economy in Europe, and through the global financial crash that was felt especially hard in that country. After earning her law degree from Queen's University in Belfast and successfully serving as a barrister, she was appointed Reed Professor of Criminal Law at Trinity College in Dublin. During her years at Trinity College, she also worked part-time as a radio and television journalist. In 1987, Ms. McAleese returned to Queen's University, where she first served as director of the Institute of Professional Legal Studies, and then became the university's first female pro-vice chancellor. She's currently pursuing a doctorate in canon law at the Gregorian University in Rome, and is in residence here at Boston College as the Burns Library Visiting Scholar in Irish Studies. We've invited her here to the Boisy Center today to speak about peace building and reconciliation, and it's my tremendous and great honor to welcome you today.
Thank you so much. Thank you. So I have the floor.
You
I?
Do.
Oh,
yes.
Gosh. Can I introduce my husband, Martin, who, like me, we're both born in Belfast. And if I just preface my remarks by telling you a little bit about where we came from and how we ended up being involved in peace and reconciliation work. We're both born in Belfast at just shortly after the Second World War. And don't do the maths. And
you're young.
So both born into, Martin's from East Belfast, I'm from North Belfast, from a parish called Ardoyne, which some of you, who any of you who are followers of Irish politics will know is one of the most difficult flashpoint areas. It's the area with the highest incidence of sectarian murders, bar none, in Ireland. And we both grew up in, ironically, in Protestant, small Protestant enclaves. 93% of all people who live in Northern Ireland live essentially in enclaves that are denominational. So we were unusual in that we lived in areas where we were either one of one Catholic family in Martin's case, or in mine, like two or three Catholic families in our area. So, and these were working class areas, areas that are today regarded as the hinterland of paramilitary violence. You would have a lot of paramilitary activity. Paramilitarism has a very, very, very long shelf life and long history in Ireland because of the political religious conflict. A conflict between an Ireland, an Irish Ireland that wants independence and that is denominationally largely Catholic, and an Ireland that is denominationally, the only time we've ever had a confessional church in Ireland was during the years of British ascendancy when Protestantism was the state church, but actually was only the religion of a very tiny number, but that tiny number of course held all political power, held all the money, all the finances, and effectively kept Catholics out of jobs, which is where we came in the 1950s. We were born into a sectarian part of Ireland. Ireland was divided after from 1922 on into Northern Ireland, essentially a Protestant state, the Republic, essentially a Catholic state. We were stuck in the northern part, and with a very, very strong leitmotif of difference, of underpinnings of violence. Little things like walking down certain streets would have been dangerous because those streets were Protestant. How did you know? Well, they were painted red, white and blue. That usually helped. And and growing up, of course, in a community where in our parents' generation, my parents left school at 14, Martin's parents would have been the same. They never got the chance for education much. And they belong to that generation who Seamus Heaney has memorably described as living under high banked clouds of resignation. In other words, this is the way the world was, just, you know, just live with it, you know, just put up with it. Don't put your heads, you know, whatever you say, say nothing, as he says in another poem. You know, don't rock any boats because you're going to make life difficult, because life had always been traditionally for generations difficult for Catholics. Penal laws and all sorts of penalties. So, our generation, a sea change happens. And what is the sea change? Education. End of the 1940s, along comes a free second level education. It just arrived in Ireland just before we were born. In Northern Ireland, not the Republic. It came 25 years later there. And suddenly, not only do we have access to free second level education, but we also have access to university. So we belong to the generation that Heaney describes memorably as intelligences brightened and unmannerly as crowbars. And so we're the generation who have social science. We start to measure. We start to figure things out. And we start, as we try to get into the professions, we discover we can't get here and we can't get there because of the social impediments by virtue of being Catholic. Excluded from jobs, excluded from voting, excluded from politics. Along comes the civil rights movement, predictably enough, in the 1960s, along with civil rights movements elsewhere. And then comes the state reaction, which is not good, and the neglect, essentially, of the British government of the time, regrettably. And what happens then is effectively civil war breaks out on our doorstep. We weren't to realise it then. I was saying earlier, Derek, that I thought that we all thought that when the violence broke out in 1969, it would last a week. And then we thought it might last a month, and then we thought it might last a year, and then it lasted over 30 years, during which time, you know, we lost our homes and we lost many friends. And so we're 18 and this is on our doorstep. And what do you do and how do you respond? Well, there are many adaptations. Some people just bury themselves in kind of a middle-class bourgeoisie bubble, you know, where everything is grand and they never talk about bad things. Some people were so provoked, so irate, so hurt, so angry, they join paramilitaries. Some get involved in politics, and we were fortunate that we both came from backgrounds where our parents encouraged us to think more imaginatively, more creatively than generations gone past, and to think in terms of persuasion and using whatever tools were available to us. I used the law to try and find ways of dealing with our neighbours from whom we were estranged, but, you know, whom we lived with and were going to be living with in perpetuity. Could we be the first generation which would use the education that we now had to deal creative and imaginatively with a centuries-old history of intercommunal conflict? And that's really that's where we decided to put ourselves on the side of those who believe in democratic politics, those who believed in open discourse, and who believed that there was the possibility for change through discourse. Eventually, I think that particular branch of thinking, which goes right back to Daniel O'Connell, the great liberator in the early part of the 19th century. Any of you who know Dublin will maybe know that the main street is called O'Connell Street, and the big statue there is called after Daniel O'Connell, the man who's notorious in Ireland for achieving Catholic emancipation from many of the penal laws of the time, getting Catholic votes, but actually was a great champion of Russian Jews, of American slaves, great friend of Frederick Douglass, the man who thought and taught that human dignity is endemic in the human person from birth, that rights are not something that government gives, but something that government protects. And he taught us that from the early part of the 19th century, and he also taught, having experienced himself the French Revolution, he was studying in France at the time of the French Revolution, he was appalled by the violence, appalled by it, and realised that violence is too heady, too giddy, too uncontrollable to ever affect anything other than hurt. And we could see that. We both lost our homes in the Troubles. My father lost his business. A young girl was killed in the explosion. He and mother of two children. Many of our friends died, were murdered. My own brother and my father were both, well, my own family, we were all victims of an attempted murder. My brother in particular, who's deaf, the victim of an attempted murder, all of these things. So how do you package all that? Do you just get angry and just do what everybody has done for the last, you know, just become another source of toxin, you know, of continuing the toxin? Or do you, could you possibly be a person who stands against the toxic tide? And that's what we decided to do. I've always been involved in anti-sectarianism, cross-community endeavour. Had tried very hard to stand in the shoes of the other. I did a series of programmes called The Protestant Mind for BBC to try and see could I begin to understand why it was, though we both talked English and lived, you know, cheek by jowl, that we actually didn't talk the same language, and discovered the extent to which the loadings in our brains from, you know, from we are little, the things that we hear load our thinking, you know, with historic memories that may or may not be accurate, but are always in a divided community designed to keep us divided, designed to ensure that we despise the other, that we fear the other, that we hate the other. And so very often we tell lies about history, or we only ransack history for those things that divide us. And when I came into office in 1997, when I saw the chance to become president, I had lived south of the border. My husband and I had both worked and lived south of the border. We were from the north. And frankly, I hope this doesn't sound just too pompous, but it happens to be true, we kind of reckoned that we knew a heck of a lot more than a lot of people who were so-called experts. We listened to all the pundits and we used to say, where did they get that from? We'd listen to politicians, we'd listen to political journalists, we would listen to political polemicists, we would listen to academics, and we would realise that something in our experience, our lived experience, something in the distillation of that had given us a kind of a unique insight and allied to a determination. We both came from the Catholic tradition, strongly catechised in the cross, strongly catechised in the great commandment to love one another. And we felt that if we pulled all those things together, we would have something special to offer in the presidency, which is essentially a pastoral role in Ireland. It has a constitutional base and it has a constitutional role in terms of legislation, but it's not like your presidency. You know, it's not a chief executive role. Thank goodness, actually, in that respect, because it gave me a kind of a pastoral space of leadership, if you like, moral leadership, that we could occupy. And I guess because people looked at us and thought, they kind of look like they know what they're doing. They let us then do things that were really very different. First of all, the theme of my presidency was building bridges. And we set out from the very beginning to make friends of our enemies. Just as simple as that. I kind of figure in peacemaking, there's no point in making peace with people that you agree with. You know, that you kind of assume that they're okay. And what you want to do now is to make peace with people who hate you and to befriend people who despise you. And there were a lot of people in Northern Ireland who despised us and the community we came from, who despised the Republic and all that it stood for, who would never come across the border, who would never, ever come to the President's house, not if they were paid. So we never paid them, but we did, over a period of 14 years, attempt to seduce them, in a sense, with something very different. And the very different thing was, because we live in a community that has different ambitions. One wants to remain part of the United Kingdom. One wants to have a United Ireland. Protestant evangelical tradition, Catholic evangelical tradition underpinning that, both are about the business of trying to turn Protestants into Catholics and Catholics into Protestants and Catholic and, you know, Unionists into Nationalists and Nationalists, heavily evangelical. And we decided to take the evangelical out of it. We didn't want to change anybody's mind about politics, but we sure wanted to befriend them, because we felt that if we could befriend our neighbours and accept them for who they are and what they are, we might actually create a platform on which we could eventually deal with difficult things, tough things, things that did separate us. But that if we only ever met around a table like this when we were talking about the tough things, we were always going to have breakdown, because we had never learnt the language of respectful engagement. We'd only ever learnt the language of conflict. And I think that what went into the Good Friday Agreement, actually with the help of our friends here in the United States and George Mitchell in particular, we learnt a new language of respectful engagement. We learnt how to negotiate better we had, the work had been done on, if you like, the Protestant, the differences between the Protestant mind and the Catholic mind. Protestant mind thinks that word has that meaning, just that one meaning. You don't like it, you create another Protestant church. That's fine. Catholics, on the other hand, well, we're a broad church, so that word, take the word collegiality, for example. We can take that word and we could stretch it 10 times around the block. And the Protestants look at that and they think, well, that is just so Jesuitical. That is just so typical of Catholics, you can't trust them. The word never means, never has a fixed meaning. And we then look at Protestants and say, well, that's just typical. They're so stubborn, you know, there's no malleability, there's no flexibility. Instant breakdown. And that had been the history of our peacemaking. Instant breakdown. Why? Because we hadn't bothered to give each other the respect of standing in each other's shoes for long enough to understand where we were coming from. So in our 14 years, we decided to try as much as we could to stand in each other's shoes. And we invited them. First of all, we invited those who would come, and we brought those who had said they would come. A lot of people said they wouldn't over their dead bodies. But after 14 years, actually, they softened and they came. And because they began to trust us, that we weren't doing this for photo ops. You know, we were not doing this for the cynical political photo op. You know, here's my pet Protestant, you know, whom I've just adopted. You know, we had been victims of all that kind of stuff ourselves, and we knew how cynical it was and how short-lived. So we wanted to build genuine friendships. My husband gave up his job as a dentist, gave up his practice, and sat on the phone for 24 hours, you know, 365 days a year, talking to people, persuading them, getting into the car, driving into paramilitary dens where police would not go to protect him. And the very fact of being there earned him respect. The fact that he'd grown up with these paramilitaries, you know, as a Catholic living in a Protestant neighbourhood, allowed him, gave him a certain amount of kudos and credibility. They couldn't pull the wool over our eyes. You know, they couldn't tell lies. And we couldn't tell lies to them because we'd all lived cheek by jowl. So over 14 years, we built the relationship. And we slowly tried also to address the areas where history had conspired to tell lies. When we were talking about earlier, the First World War, for example. We grew up with a story which said that only Protestants in the North took part in the First World War. You know, they wore British uniform. Now, during the First World War, the 1418 War, Ireland was an undivided country, still part of the British imperial apparatus, still a British colony. But they did not introduce conscription. And the truth of the story is, 250,000 people out of a population of 2.5 million volunteered. That means everybody, somebody and everybody and everybody's family volunteered. Of those, 50,000 did not come home. They died. Many more came back wounded and injured and ill, traumatised. Who were they? Well, the Protestant narrative said they were entirely Northern Protestants or occasional Southern Protestants. The truth is, the vast majority were Irish Catholics, the vast majority were Irish nationalists, the vast majority of those who died were Irish Catholics. How did we end up with this stupid narrative? You know, that completely eliminated the Catholic contribution and lionised the Protestant contribution. Was it that the Protestants, you know, just were better at telling the story? Actually, no, the Catholics didn't want the truth told either. Why? Because in the middle of the 1418 War, we had a rising against British rule called the Rising in Easter 1916. And when the men came back wearing British uniforms, the Irish nationalists came back to Dublin, to Cork, to Limerick wearing the uniforms, they were regarded as traitors. Why weren't they at home fighting the British? Why were they fighting in British uniform? So it suited the Catholic narrative, the narrative of those who wanted a united Ireland, to bury the fact that so many of their own contemporaries fought in British uniform. So those stories went into shoeboxes and in attics to be ignored. Meanwhile, the Protestants were able to say, only we fought for the small nations of Europe. And that suited their narrative, the narrative that Catholics couldn't be trusted, that they were disloyal to the crown, that they were disloyal to Britain. And this made, you know, one side more British and one side more intensely Irish. We lived cheek by jowl and we didn't tell the truth about history, and that's only one small example. So then we started to break that story open. And we went to Messines with Queen Elizabeth, and there we launched a peace tower in memory of the Irish men who died in the 1914-18 war. And we told the story of nationalists and Protestants and Catholics and people, atheists and all sorts of people who went and fought. And suddenly, those who never stood together at a cenotaph, because cenotaphs were all British things, suddenly they weren't so British anymore. Suddenly they were about Irishmen. And so quietly all around Ireland, we now have new monuments to these people who died. And we're able to draw into discourse together Catholics and Protestants who historically never talked about these things. That's only one small example. And the final culmination, and I'll finish off with this and give you time to talk. The final culmination for us, we got the Good Friday Agreement. We had the changing of attitudes between North and South. Suddenly the Northern government and the Southern government started to work together, which they never had done historically. Relations between Dublin and London were very good. The Good Friday Agreement, they were the joint custodians of. They were working well together from John Major's time on, from the end of Margaret Thatcher, whose era was a disaster for Anglo-Irish relations. But from John Major on, a completely different temper, much more respectful, working towards a common agenda, helped by our membership with the European Union and helped by our friends here in the United States. And then within Northern Ireland, where the real tied knot is, a government underpinned by the Good Friday Agreement, a raft of legislation based on this thing called parity of esteem. Every citizen entitled to parity of esteem. And a referendum held north and south to show that the extent of public support for the new dispensation that was created by the Good Friday Agreement, overwhelmingly endorsed by these referenda, very clever idea because it gave public ownership now of this new treaty, this international treaty, which said to the British in Ireland, Northern Ireland is part of the United Kingdom. Very hard for people like me to say, you know, who regarded it as a stolen colony. Northern Ireland is part of the United Kingdom, legitimately, and will remain so for as long as that is the wish of the people of Northern Ireland. But if the people of Northern Ireland change their mind and want a united Ireland, then the two governments, the Irish government and the British government, will work to bring that about. So everybody, in other words, this is a win-win for everybody. Everybody compromises, everybody gets something. And the culmination of the working out of that, which has given us effectively, you know, 15, 16 years of peace now, an unsteady peace, because we're only beginning to change, you know, a centuries old culture. So we've a lot of work to continue to do. But for us, the culmination of it really was the visit of Queen Elizabeth in 2011. She had never come to Ireland for obvious reasons. She'd never been able to come. And we believe very firmly that when we arrived at a state where the Good Friday Agreement was embedded, was solid, was robust, had proved itself, and had delivered, that would be a good time to invite the Queen of England to come as on a state visit and a visit of reconciliation. And we had 4 days that were described subsequently, mind you, having not everybody wanted her, not everybody thought it was a good idea. A lot of people thought it was a very bad idea. A lot of people, you know, were very worried about her security and all of that. But anyway, we had 4 wonderful days, and they were summarised for me by a wonderful old lady who wrote to me and said, I'm an old Republican. Now, Republican in Irish terms is not the same thing as an Republican. Somebody who believes in a united Ireland passionately, and possibly the use of violence to achieve it. And she said, I'm an old Republican. I hate monarchs. I hate the British. I hate what they did to my country. And I particularly have no time for the monarch next door, and I didn't want her here. And I thought you were wrong to invite her. But out of respect for you, she said, I decided to watch the first 5 minutes of her visit on television. And then she said, 4 days later, the television hadn't been turned off and nearly spontaneously combusted. And she said, when the Queen left, having cried for 4 days, she said she felt that the visit was choreographed by the angels. And that, I felt, that was the vindication for me. 14 years, we said, going through the door of the House of the President, let's see if this great commandment to love one another really works. And the day we left, we felt very strongly that it worked.
So thank you so much.